This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, we've had a fantastic week as ever, including a cycle track, a living artwork, and a stiff upper lip all round.
I am happy, I'm incredibly happy. I'm just kind of, I'm quite...
A bit of an adrenaline rush.
I'm very British, so I'm not going to whoop and cheer too much, but you know.
I heard you from the back of the boat,
you did. Whoop, I did actually, yeah, you're right, I did whoop. Oh my goodness. Whew, done. Two more to go though.
Nice to hear somebody happy.
It was fantastic. We'll get a bit more details later on, but we were on a boat for 8 hours, and it was all miserable as not very happy people in a horrible sea. And then suddenly, as you can hear, there's a bit of whooping from the front.
You were actually going up the West Coast a couple of weeks ago on holiday in your boat, Josephine.
Yeah.
How busy was it?
It was pretty busy. Well, actually, quite lucky the first day we went down the coast, down to Jura. We're on the beach in Jura. Fantastic sunny day. It was quite quiet. And then came back up to Tobermory. Absolutely mobbed. Trying to find somewhere to anchor. Not a chance.
I was asking that for a reason, because I was in Tobermory the other week. And never mind trying to anchor in the bay. Trying to get down the main street was pandemonium. Well, I didn't know, but it turns out that the harbour is actually community owned. Brian Swinbanks, a chairman of the Harbour Association, I asked him, the ownership thing, how did that happen?
It actually started many, many years ago as just a community committee that was set up actually at the request of the HIDB way back in 1983 to set up someone who could take control of what could potentially happen in the harbour. And at that time, they were thinking of just moorings and who would run those in Tobermory. And we stepped up and said we'd do that. So once we'd stepped up to say we could do that, things really started to take off. And it was really about 1987 that we began to realise that the motor car was dominant in Tobermory. So we decided that we need to build a car park. And that's the car park that we're standing in right now, adjacent to the harbour. That car park became a tremendous focus. It was a catalyst for the town. New pubs, new restaurants, new visitor centres for the distillery. Everything took off from that point. So the next problem was to reorganise the whole bay. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like you see today. It was just a mishmash, a burach of moorings, quite honestly. People just put them down wherever, because the Crown Estate had been absent for many years from the West Coast. But we thought, we want to work with the Crown Estate. Mm-hmm. So we said we'd reorganise the whole bay. We'd take all the moorings out, every single local mooring, and we'd put them all back in again. The HIDB came on board, offered us 50%, and we had to find somewhere over 25,000 at that time to reorganise the bay.
Can I just ask you, how do you go about planning something like this? Because you've got a finite amount of space. It must be like laying out a car park, but on the water.
Very much so, actually. We've actually got plans, and they're actually upstairs there, where we laid out a grid of moorings. So what we have is a grid of moorings where we have the wee boats inshore, and you can see them there. You've got little boats, 16, 18, 20 feet, and the first moorings are just a single block or a trot, going out to two blocks, going out to three blocks, going out for big moorings to up to 75, 80 feet out there. And then you've got fishing boats who are working still off an 1814 pier, and one of the good things is we had the fishermen involved early. They were the friends of the Tobermory Harbour Association. So there was no alienation in this community. Everybody was working together.
That's quite unusual in itself.
Yes. We had all the stakeholders. We had small boat owners, yacht clubs, everything like that, all working together. They were all stakeholders in this original association. So it took 2 years to get through. So we take all these moorings out, and we then get a contractor in, and we borrow 25,000 at our own risk from the bank. I remember going into the bank over there and saying, can we borrow 25,000? And they said, what for? And I said, to redo the whole moorings. Yes. Match funding? Yes. So they did. They lent us 25 grand. So we get all the moorings out. We put in fairways. The fairway is now recognised on all Admiralty charts.
And this what is a fairway? Explain that.
A fairway, it can be no moorings, nothing. There's just buoys. There's
like a safe channel.
Yes, a safe channel. That's a beautiful phrase for it. Because boats were still coming in those days fishing at night. They were going out herring fishing. There were ring netters still here. They were catching lots of fish in the old days, and they would come back in during the night. So we had to keep that clear.
What we're looking at the moment is, I mean, across there you've got a forest of masts and the yachts and things like that. Some very big boats kicking around out there, some very expensive boats. What difference does having this make to Tobermory, to Mull?
Well, it's what I call, and it's a new phrase that I invented, a binary benefit, right? So the Harbour Association, now a Harbour Authority, that's what we are now, actually gets the benefit of the people going alongside and paying us to be alongside our infrastructure. But the town gets a massive benefit. So if the Harbour Association turns over £400,000 to £500,000, ECOS has calculated that the spend in this town here from the visitors' floats is 2.6 million.
Wow.
And I would say it's probably near £3 million spend in this town from
visitors. What are ECOS?
They're just a consultancy that worked up the figures.
But given the fact that, you know, this is a community enterprise, as with all of these things, and you start off with, I always describe it as the half dozen willing horses, you know, and they tend to be a bit older, more struck in years, etc.
Yes.
And of course, they get old and they want to sort of step back off this. Have you got problems with succession here, or are people coming forward to say, yeah, I'll take this on?
Yeah, we have got some problems, right? And the biggest succession problem is myself, right? Mm-hmm. I've been here ever since 83. I've been around, you know...
That's 1983.
Yeah. 1983, yes, exactly.
Just
not
joking,
1883, okay? So I'm stepping back, and we looked at this and how we were going to do it and to get people to do this, and what we decided to do was actually raise the competency of our staff to get better staff in, so that if any of us step back, there will be a great staff there running it day to day. And that's the reinforcement policy we've put in. We've got good board members, from transport operators to people who've retired to Mull. Now we want to get young people in. Now, what we're actually genuinely saying is we want applications for young people. We've got two director positions open. We would really like to get people, you know, 18, 20, 25 on the board of the THA. We want to grow that. We're also trying to work with the school. We're talking to the school to see if we can do something in the future about future-proofing the whole thing.
You've obviously done a tremendous amount in and around the harbour. Have you topped out, you know, in terms of its potential, or can you squeeze more out of it?
Oh, no, there's loads more to do, actually, because Tobermory is actually a hub port. Tobermory is the gateway to the Isles, to the Western Isles, to the Northwest. After Tobermory, after this harbour, you've got to go round Ardnamurchan. You've got to get out to the small isles and on and up to Stornoway and up to Malleg and everything else like that. Now, we want people to come in here. We welcome come in here 2 or 3 days, stay here, and then on to these other ports when the weather's really good. Now, what we've got to do, and this is a new phase here, this pontoon, the north arm here, is just new in this year. This is a much bigger pontoon that can take these big boats like the Royalist and these small, tall ships that we've now got sitting on there alongside.
So essentially, you're not going to get bored anytime soon?
Never going to get bored. There's lots more projects to do. There's absolutely loads more to do in Tobermory. It's endless. It really is.
Brian Swinbanks, Chairman of Tobermory Harbour Association.
They need more pontoons. I was in there and it was absolutely mobbed. And it was mobbed, as you were pointing out, big boats.
Yes.
Really big boats.
Now, some very, very big boats.
Yeah. And I suppose, as everybody's pointing out there, it's a gateway to the Western Isles. Really popular. It does mean you're really restricted in where you can anchor for nothing. It's like the right to roam, as you have the right to anchor anywhere, but if it's all buoys and chains and stuff, you can't anchor there. So that's a more difficult one. There's some really deep water on the far side of the bay that you can anchor in. But
How deep?
Oh, it's something like 60 metres, something like that.
Wow.
Somebody's going to correct me on that, but when we did it, it was right at the end of my chain.
Aye. Yes. Oh, well. Every year, there's something called International Bog Day. It's celebrated worldwide on the fourth Sunday in July. Now, I'm more or less guaranteed, as you're sitting here listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast, it will have been in your diary.
Yeah, absolutely. I love bogs. I think they're fantastic things. There's so much going on in them, and so many around the world. And as you said, it was International Bog Day. And now, dragonflies love bogs as well. And I met up with dragonfly expert Danielle Muir to find out how significant bogs can be.
They're really important habitats for humans and for wildlife. They're really important for us in that they absorb lots of water, so they act as a bit like a sponge, so they can help to slow down flooding. They act for wildlife. They're quite rare habitats these days, though here in Scotland we've been working quite a lot to restore lots of bogs. And lots of wildlife is reliant on bogs, including the wonderful dragonfly.
But why is it so special? What is it? I mean, it's kind of, it's a very rich habitat that people don't necessarily identify as being really important. But what is it about bogs that's so special?
It's a mix of land and water. So sphagnum, which is really important for producing peat and building up bogs and working to sort of mitigate the effects of climate change because they absorb carbon, is a great habitat for lots of wildlife to live in. So our dragonflies lay their eggs in the sphagnum, lots of their larvae live within the sphagnum itself. And obviously there's lots of wildlife that likes to feed on dragonflies, along with all the other wildlife that lives in the bog.
But it's a real living habitat, isn't it? Even as you walk along it, it's moving, it's alive.
Yes, well, you've got to be very careful when you're walking across a bog that you don't fall down a bog hole. So yes, they're vibrant habitats.
Really special.
They're just wonderful places, yes.
Dragonflies. You've touched on it twice already, but that's your job. First of all, what is a dragonfly?
A dragonfly is an insect. It belongs to the group Odonata, which means toothed jaw, which is relating to how they feed. And they've been around for over 300 million years. So they've been around since before the time of the dinosaurs. So they're very, very ancient insects. And in that time, they've not changed that much in design, but they're a lot smaller than they used to be. So they used to have a 3-foot wingspan. Gotcha. And now...
it's a big thing.
Now, although our big dragonflies are big, they're a lot smaller than that. So dragonflies are predators. And when we think of dragonflies, we tend to think of these wonderful, brightly coloured jewels flying around. But in actual fact, they spend most of their life underwater. As larvae, and some of our species such as the golden ring dragonfly, which are found in upland burns, rivers for example, can live 5 or even 6 years underwater as a larva, and then as adults they just last a few weeks.
Do they eat when they're out flying?
Yes, so they're voracious predators when they're both larvae, and as adults we should all love dragonflies because they eat midges, they eat mosquitoes, they eat flies, they eat blue bottles, they'll even eat wasps.
So do they chase them down?
They're amazing to watch actually when they're flying. They put their legs up behind their head so that they're more streamlined when they're flying, and when they come across a prey item, they'll quite often use their arms to sort of trap the prey, and then they'll transfer it to their mouth and they'll eat it there. And sometimes they'll do that whilst they're flying. Sometimes they'll land when they're
eating their prey. Must be quite spectacular, right? I've seen quite a lot of dragonflies. I've never seen that.
Well, you need to watch them carefully because they have sort of thousands and thousands of cells in their eyes. So they've got really, really good eyesight. And dragonflies especially, because when we talk about dragonflies, we mean dragonflies and damselflies. We have 23 breeding species here in Scotland. Dragonflies especially, because they've got such huge eyes. They're really, really good predators. And, you know, it's not a big deal. They'll just sort of, they're very fast. They've got 4 wings. They can go forward, they can go back, they can hover, they can go up, they can go down. So they're really, really good flyers, and they'll just sort of nip out of the way of their flight to catch a green fly, for example, quickly eat it while they're flying and just keep going.
Do they hunt? Because I've been privileged to have some dragonflies in my pond, and they just seem to patrol like bats back and forward.
Yeah. Well, what they're doing there is they're patrolling their territory. So it's probably a male that you're watching, and he is making sure that there's no other males coming to your pond. He's making sure that he can see where any females come to the pond, because the females only come back to the water when they're ready to mate. And you'll be able to see while they're patrolling, they'll sort of veer away and it looks like they're catching something and eating something, and then they'll go back to patrolling round and round.
But they really are solar powered. I've been out there and you look at a bog or whatever and there's nothing. Suddenly the sun comes out and woof!
Yeah, definitely. So you need a sunny day to get really good sightings of dragonflies. Though on a day like this where it's a bit overcast, we've got a bit of hair here today,
at Morton Locks, which is one of our dragonfly hotspots, then because they're not flying around, they're possibly easier to see close up because they'll be resting on the vegetation, just waiting for the sun to warm them up, and then they'll burst into flight.
You say we're at Morton Locks at the moment, but you've got a couple of events this weekend. Were you going to guarantee dragonflies?
Well, you can never guarantee wildlife, unfortunately. I wish we could, but it's very likely that we're going to see dragonflies because we're going to two really good spots for dragonflies. So I'll go to Muir of Dinnet National Nature Reserve, and we'll be visiting the moss there, which is a great spot for one of our rare dragonflies, the northern damselfly. And then on Sunday we have an event at NTS Castle Fraser, and again, Castle Fraser is a fantastic spot. It's one of our first ever key sites, which are really good sites for rare species, and it's a really good spot to see the northern damselfly there as well.
And everybody should go and see a dragonfly. I get beside myself with excitement when I see a dragonfly.
I find it very exciting as well. But I would say yes, it's one of the quintessential sightings of summer is watching dragonflies close to a pond or a river or a burn. And there's nothing nicer than being out on a sunny day watching wildlife, especially dragonflies, when the sun's shining.
Danielle Muir of the British Dragonfly Society. I love the idea of a dragonfly with a 3-foot wingspan.
That's been
great. I want one of those.
Yeah, but it's been replaced by the drone, isn't it?
How well?
The dragonfly of today.
You perhaps don't know this, but...
Many things.
Many things. The drone was developed using a branch of engineering called biomimetics, where engineers mimic what happens in nature, and they were basically trying to reproduce the abilities of the dragonfly, which can fly forwards, backwards, sideways, you know, you name it, more or less turn at right angles instantaneously. And they came up with a drone after studying the dragonfly.
Well, I have a drone, and it doesn't have wings. It's got propellers.
Well, it's like little wings that go round, that's all. It's the same kind of theory.
Yeah.
You need to work with me here. Anyway, for some people, this is... I was talking high tech, lower tech. Riding a bike is something just to take for granted, but for others, just getting on a bike can prove very difficult. The Highlands Cyclability Centre, based at Cawdor near Nairn, is the UK's only cyclability centre. Now, it offers a really safe environment to experience the pleasures of cycling, sometimes for the first time for people. Simon Cherrett is the centre manager.
A couple of weeks ago, I opened the track up on a Saturday just to allow people the opportunity to come to the track who maybe, you know, can't get here because of work, because of school, etc. There's one young lad who turned up with his dad, and the young lad, 14 years old, has a bit of a heart issue, a heart problem. So he hadn't ridden a bike in the best part of 4 years. So he turned up with his dad. We got a bike out of the shed for him, and he was excited to be here, but apprehensive. He was a little bit worried about what was going to happen. We got him to sit down on the bike, no feet on the pedals, and just to push himself along as if he was on a balance bike to start off with. And within 10 metres of doing that, he got his feet up on the pedals and he was riding the bike, and the first time in ages. The smile on his face was brilliant. He was so relaxed. He was so happy to be able to be out riding a bike. So with his dad and me, we came out to the track. And the young lad, he rode around the track under control of his dad, with his dad's guidance. He put in 4 laps of the track. And as he finished the last lap, he came in, he parked the bike up, looked at his dad, and the first words out of his mouth were, "Dad, please can I have my own bike now?"
That's brilliant. Good stuff. How did this track come to be?
Back in 2013, when the idea was mooted that an all-ability cycle centre would be an ideal thing to have. The family who own the farm and the land that we have the track on, they're the people behind it all as well. They came up with the idea. They sourced fundings through various people, and basically they graciously gave up part of their land, part of their farm, and put the track into place. Away from the main building, we've got a few handfuls of a few small sheds which house our bicycle fleet, which has been created and built up over the last few years since the centre opened. To provide bikes for all abilities for people to come in and use, from the standard two-wheel bicycle up to a four-wheel off-road gator.
Can you buy these kind of things off the peg, or do you have to more or less get them built?
You can buy them off the peg. There are companies that provide them all. They're not cheap, though.
No, they wouldn't be.
No.
They wouldn't be. So essentially, you've got quite a few tricycles here that I can see.
Yeah, we've got a
hand crank bike too.
Hand crank bike. We've got KMX recumbent bikes as well, which are the bikes which you see laid down with people lay down into the seat and the pedals are in front of them. Mm-hmm. We've got a few other hand bikes. We've also got trikes, bucket bikes, which as part of the process will go out to old people's homes on our outreach programs. Uh-huh. Quad 4x4 bikes, uh-huh. running bikes, and my favourite is the Gator Berg bikes over there, which are... They're my favourite because they're a bit off-road, but they're also battery-assisted as well, so it makes going uphill a little bit easier.
That's pretty chunky, I must confess. I mean, I looked at that and thought, that can't be a bicycle because it's too heavy. It's got four seats in it for a start.
Four seats. So when we have schools come up, we had one of the local primary schools come up to visit as part of the Highland Sustrans programme the other week, and some of the kids that came up, they can't ride or they didn't have bikes. So we took one of these... bigger bikes out with the four seats on. One of the members of staff got in it and we just rode round and round the track with these kids, building up their confidence, but just generally having a good bit of fun with them as well.
I see you've got the Landy there and a big trailer.
Yes.
Do people need to come here all the time? Because can you go to them?
No, we go to them. So we conduct what we refer to as our outreach programme. Uh-huh. It runs throughout the whole of the year and we cover... the Highlands and the islands. Up till now at the minute the furthest we've got out is to Stornoway. Uh-huh. We've been down to Stirling, we go across to Aberdeen, we support within our local community as well, going out to, I mentioned earlier on, to like Lossiemouth, uh-huh. Kinloss, Elgin and Keith, to name a few places, but we're also now trying to create a new programme, mm-hmm. where we are heading up to Orkney, followed by the Shetland Islands.
That's brilliant.
So take the bikes up there.
Yeah. I have to say, the fact that you have a facility here, which is essentially off-road, is a huge advantage.
It's brilliant. It's safe. It's secure. The guys and girls have come, or our customers come. They jump onto the bikes in the car park. Uh-huh. We then control the... access and egress of them coming in and out of the car park.
The sign here saying no vehicles, cycles only.
Yeah, cycles only. We don't have any vehicles on the track, purely for that safety element. We've got someone riding around the track over there, look.
I can see that's a big track.
Yeah, so the track is 1 kilometre, as it used to be. Recently, we've just had an extra part put in, which we've aptly titled the Adventure Track. It's a little bit...
It's not finished yet. Yeah.
it's a little bit of fun. It's got a few little lumps and bumps, a bit of a sharp corner in it. Uh-huh. But we've put things in place to make sure that it's all safe and content. And that now adds the track up to being 1.2 kilometres in length.
How do you describe, you know, when they're paired up like that? Because those are basically, they're not... tandems, because they're side by side quads.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you describe the roles? So there's the rider and what?
So there's the rider and the client or the customer. So what we got there? We've got a bucket bike and a side by side quad bike there. Uh-huh. So there on each of those there'll be the client or the customer and their carer, I suppose is the best way of putting it.
These two young lads here, your clients, I saw them in the car park. The one behind was just beside himself with excitement. He was so happy to be here.
We see so many people that come through that once they pull in through the gates, they realise where they are, the excitement level starts to go up.
Yeah.
You start to see the smiles and the communication sometimes can Hiya. Be... Hi.
How you doing? Hello.
Hey. lots of the customer base... Some of them are non-verbal.
Yeah.
So guys come in and you see the smiles arrive on the face, the excitement starts to go up, they come over, they want to be on the bike, they want to be having fun. Because in most aspects, this is the first and only opportunity that they've had to ride a bike outside. Not for all of our customers, admittedly, but for the vast majority.
One of the things that's worth pointing out here, just in case any other farmers are listening, is that the track runs round the outside of a big field. That big field is still being farmed. They've lost the land round the outside, but aside from that, it's still working farm.
It's still a working farm. You know, there's access points across the track. They've reinforced the track where vehicles may cross over, agricultural vehicles will cross over it. But for all intents and purposes, when I came here for my first look at the centre back in April, the centre of the field was a field full of sheep.
Yeah.
And now it's getting ready to be made to silage.
Not just in terms of... we take people here, we put them on bicycles, we run them round. On a deeper level, what does this place do? How would you describe it to somebody? What does it give people?
The centre provides an opportunity for people who may never have the possibility of riding a bike. It gets guys and girls out who may not be able to ride bikes, and by doing so, providing that, it gives them an opportunity to enhance not only their physical but also their mental well-being as well.
Simon Chennett of the Highland Cyclability Centre. It is a cracking resource. It really is. What a good idea it is.
Kind of feeling it should be rolled out across the country, though.
Yeah.
Three centres near every area of population.
And it's not, you know, it's not as land intensive as you might think. As I say, I mean, basically that track runs round the perimeter of a really big field. It runs up woodland on one side, but essentially the field is still being used on a day-to-day basis for agriculture. They haven't taken that much of it away.
But you could use it in parks as well, where there's existing infrastructure.
Uh-huh.
Or running tracks.
Indeed.
Or running round football pitches.
Yeah. But you would have been interested in all the various types of bikes, you know, some of which were battery-powered.
Yeah. Well, saying that, I mentioned earlier on, we're down in Jura, and honestly, it was best day of the year, not a cloud in the sky. There is a beautiful beach in Jura.
Mm-hmm.
And hired some bikes, proper bikes, and had a great cycle. It was just fantastic, up into the hills, and it was just wonderful. All the crickets just scraping away. It was wonderful. Great.
Did you, by any chance, while you were sailing, see any basking sharks?
No. You know, I saw nothing.
Really?
I saw about three seals, not a dolphin, not a minke whale, not a basking
shark. Is this your
minke? You know, I'm in the right area, absolutely in the right area.
Yeah, but nothing.
But saw nothing. I did see three sea eagles
mm-hmm,
in Lough Spelvy, which was also delightful. Have you been to Lough Spelvy and Mull? It's got the tiniest entrance. It's about 20 metres across.
Wow.
And it's like a Walt Disney Pirates thing. You go through this tiny entrance, it opens out in this massive, big seawater lock. It's great. I had the whole lock to myself. It's wonderful. Now, earlier this year, we brought in the news that the Scottish Government have started a consultation on an extension of the Marine Protected Area Network. And as part of that consultation, a team of scientists are attempting to tag basking sharks with video cameras to see just where they do, and if they do, breed in Scotland. And as we'll hear, it's not that easy.
My name's Dr. Lucy Hawkes. I'm from the University of Exeter. We have left the Isle of Mull from the port of Tobermory. We're heading out to south of Tiree, which we're hoping is going to be today's home for basking shark tagging.
It's a big old swell here, a big powerful motor. The sun's coming out. Is it a good day for spotting them? Because it's quite difficult to see anything.
Yeah, sometimes it feels that way. The flatter the water conditions, the easier it is to spot basking sharks, but we can do it today. Fortunately, although the waves are pretty big, basking sharks' dorsal fins are massive, so hopefully we'll be able to do it.
I always find it amazing that the second biggest fish in the world, it's really mysterious. You know, it's steeped in folklore, mythology. People know very little about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have a really strong history up here in Scotland of hunting basking sharks too. So over several decades, certainly at least thousands and thousands of basking sharks were killed, primarily for their oily livers, which were used for heating and lighting. But today, basking sharks are endangered with extinction. So we are doing our best to try to make sure that we provide them with really safe areas that they can continue to breed and survive in.
Now, you've got some fancy bits of kit here. In fact, there's a loaded with bits of technology. What have we got? What are you going to do?
So since 2012 we've been tracking basking sharks using satellite transmitters that send us a location so we can find out where sharks are. And now we know a lot about where basking sharks are in Scottish waters. I can tell you now that this part of Colin Tyree is an incredibly significant, important place for them. But what we haven't known until now is what they're really doing here. We know they are here, but we don't know why they're here. And so the main pieces of equipment we brought with us on our trip are cameras. So we have two types of cameras. One of the cameras is directly attached to the shark, and it will film what the shark can see. And it will also film what's travelling along behind the shark.
So there's two cameras in this?
Two cameras, one facing forwards, one facing backwards on a single device that's towed along behind the shark. What we really, really want to see is breeding. We think that Scotland may be the one place in the world that basking sharks are breeding. And if that is, it means it's even more important than we already think it is.
It's quite a big camera though. How long does it stay on?
It can stay on for as long as we want it to, but we've been keeping it on for just over 3 days, and that's because that's when the batteries in the camera stop recording. So it will stay on the shot for 3 days. It does seem big, but when you actually see it on the basking shot, which of course can be up to 10 metres long, it's actually tiny.
What's the other one you've got there as well? Little spaceship.
So I've also got another thing that looks like an orange space rocket from Wallace and Gromit's Grand Day Out. It's an amazing looking thing. I love the shape of it. This is actually essentially a pinging device. So we attach it to the shark and it's constantly pinging. It's constantly emitting a message saying, I'm over here, I'm over here. And we've got this amazing robot that's come over from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution with some of the world's leading engineers. And what they're doing is actually using this robot to follow this beacon and work out where the shark is. And the robot itself is like a robot cameraman. So this robot is filming the shark. It's looking forwards, left, right, up and down. And so it's following the shark and should be able to spot both what the shark is doing and also which other sharks are around.
It's early days yet, but what kind of footage are you getting?
The footage is amazing. It's really unique for us to see things from the shark's perspective. We've seen a couple of really weird things. One is basking sharks actually sitting on the bottom of the sea. So they're down on the bottom in kelp, in sand,
over
rocks.
Just sitting there?
Well, they're probably feeding. They're probably in a water current, so they're probably keeping their mouths open and plankton still flowing across their gills. But in the past, we tracked basking sharks travelling to about 20 metres depth. We assumed they were sitting there in open water, but now we're starting to realise that perhaps some of the time they're actually on the bottom.
Because there was a theory up until relatively recently that they used to hibernate.
Yeah, and we've been looking for that in our data because we were kind of half expecting to see that. We don't think we've seen it yet, though. We've tracked nearly 80 sharks and we've not seen any evidence of that so far. I think most of us thought that basking sharks would probably leave Scottish waters in the winter. We thought the water gets too cold, maybe it's not that productive. And some sharks do. Some sharks are travelling down as far south as the Azores and Madeira. But what we're finding is that for the majority, sharks are remaining in the British Isles. They love this part of Scotland. They're travelling around Ireland as well. But these are very British Isles sharks.
So do they may breed here. Do they give birth here, or is it one of these we don't know yet?
That's another thing we don't know. People have seen juvenile basking sharks. They look like when they're born, they're about the size of a kayak. And they look really weird. They have a really odd-looking nose. It's almost got this kind of groove in it. It's very sort of snouty, weird-looking animals. And it's possible people have seen them and not realised they were a juvenile basking shark. But they've only been seen a handful of times, and we've never seen a basking shark breed, and we've never seen one give birth.
There's a couple of interesting theories about the groove on the young sharks, though, as well.
I had heard something about it can help them to actually feed on yolk while they're still inside the mother, but again, this has been very poorly studied.
Because they have millions or certainly thousands of eggs, but they only give birth to 3 or 4.
Yep, yeah, very, very few offspring, which is why it's even more important that these waters here are protected, not only because basking sharks are here anyway, but particularly because they may be breeding in these waters.
Are we going to see any today?
I'm very hopeful we're going to see some. So this particular part of Tyree that we're going to, we've been going there for a week now, and every time we've been, we've seen a basking shark. So I'm very hopeful.
Dr. Lucy Hawkes, don't you just love that level of enthusiasm?
Yeah, and optimism as well. 8 hours without seeing a basking shark. 8 hours.
You hear more of that coming up on the rest of the podcast. Far up on the southern edges of the Pentland Hills, there's Little Sparta. Now, it's in a remote location. The last time I was there was probably knocking on for about 10 years ago. Little Sparta was the brainchild of a guy called Ian Hamilton Finlay, and he created it along with his wife Sue. Ian was many, many things, a poet, a writer, an artist, a gardener. And Little Sparta, which he created over 50 years ago, started to create over 50 years ago, combines all of those talents. George Gilliland is the current gardener.
Rig, keel, schooner, ketch, wherry, lugger, bark, ship, sloop, brigantine, snow, barge, barkatine, cutter, yawl. We've just come down the entrance path to the front garden at Little Sparta. As a garden, it's not so much an arrangement of plants as it is a placement of ideas. It's the garden of Ian Hamilton Finlay, poet and artist, He came here in 1966, so the garden is now just over 50 years old. It contains almost 280 individual artworks, but it's all meant to be seen, read and understood as a whole.
The paving stones are marked with the names of various types of mostly sailing ships. Mm-hmm. This section here, is this the Garden of the Sea?
The whole garden has several main themes. So the first is, as you mentioned, it's the Garden
no
of the
borders.
Sea. No. We're as physically far from the sea as you can get in either direction, but it's to do with the romantic notion of the sea. The sound of the wind whooshing through the tree canopy echoes the sound of the waves. There are numerous references also to fishing boats or fishing boat names, which often are the names, say, of wives or sweethearts or figures from mythology. So they contain within them their own sort of found poetry. So that's, I think, why he links us back to the idea of the sea, and it's present through all the pieces in the garden.
Even this section, I mean, the tree here, I've got a couple of these at home and I wouldn't have crossed my mind to actually do this. It's cut off at about roughly a 5 foot level, but it's carved. Roses, roses, roses.
Yes, I mean, words appear everywhere. It's a garden of language. So I think reintroducing the idea of language or poetry into the landscape really extended what it was that he was doing or trying to discover what a garden could be. It's not just entering into a green space. It's entering into a thoughtful or an intellectual space as well.
How did you come to be the gardener here? Because I can see this two ways. Uh-huh. Either this is the best gardening job on the planet, or it's an absolute nightmare, because he's left no instructions.
It is somewhere in between the two, yes. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure to be here, and it's still a process of discovery for me every day. But it's also trying to gauge what it is that he would have wanted and how he would like the garden to be represented. So in many ways, it's about decay and the passage of time, but it's also you have to intervene at times and stop that. So, for instance, if you can't actually read an inscription, it becomes pointless. So you have to either clean it or repair it or renew it. So it's just trying to understand what it was that he wanted at the end of the day as well. But I mean, it's not only that. I mean, the presence of the artworks themselves. I mean, the garden itself continues to grow with trees, and so which get out of proportion in relation to the artwork, so that, you know, something that's really tiny can end up looking like a little toy underneath. Uh-huh. You know, so it's trying to understand there where you know, trees can be replaced or removed. But I mean, they had to put in all of these trees to start with. There was none of the planted environment, uh-huh. So they had to make a windbreak to create a little microclimate or microenvironment underneath. Otherwise, we would still be in windswept hillsides. So,
were you always a gardener? Were you an artist and a gardener? I mean, how do you see your role?
Well, I mean, I knew him, I suppose, in the late 90s, and I came here just as someone who really admired his work to visit him, never thinking that I would end up working here. And I wasn't working as a gardener at the time. I was working in contemporary art world. But there's always been a strange sort of link that keeps coming up with him and his work and my interests. They finally overlapped when I changed career and became a gardener. And then this garden came up, and it just seemed like a natural move to make. So I hope that, you know, that brings something of a sense of continuity to the work in the garden as well, or certainly an empathy to what it was that he was trying to achieve.
But it must be damn near a unique job, because, I mean, you know, effectively you are curating a collection which is growing, changing, mutating, decaying, all of the above.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just a process of gardening and working with plants. It is working with the artworks as well, and understanding those. So, and also as a gardener, it doesn't apply to the usual rules. In many senses, it's a wild garden. So it, you know, we're sitting in the middle of moorland. So he embraces that and uses it. He doesn't try to work against it. So it was a process of trial and error for them to start with, to see what plants would work and what would survive, and then that informed you know, how they made things. But it's all somehow in harmony now. It works as a whole piece.
See, again, there are so many, the name Little Sparta. Again, originally, as I understand it, that was a reaction to the Athens of the North, the art establishment in Edinburgh and things, but there are so many classical references throughout this garden.
That's correct. I mean, it started off with the name Stony Path. But then, as he decided he wanted to make a classical garden after ideas of ancient Greece and Rome, the outbuildings were transformed into temples, which you can see here, the temple to Apollo and also one to Bossus and Philemon.
These are farm outbuildings.
Absolutely. But I mean, he's elevated them into the idea of a garden temple. And then this was the building that became controversial in his lifetime because he claimed it was a religious building. If you have a religious building, you don't have to pay tax. And obviously the local authorities saw it in a different way. So he did actually go to war with them.
HMRC saw it in a different way, as I recall.
Absolutely. So it's Strathclyde region were his enemies. So, yeah. But he gathered his supporters and they saw off the sheriff's officer, which was in itself an artistic event and quite funny and humorous, but it was laced with a strongly held principle that a garden temple should have the same status as any other religious building. They're strongly held beliefs, but they're just made in a way that just doesn't sit readily with common understanding or how we normally encounter things.
Gardener George Gilliland, and you hear more from my trip around Little Sparta later in the podcast.
Slightly bizarre and left the field, to put it mildly.
Yeah, because I'm cracking stuff in it, though. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. We got a cracking email from Doug Stewart, who said, I've previously got in contact with you to say how your programme inspired me to walk again following a stroke I had in January 2018. My recovery's gone so well, I decided to fulfil a long-held ambition to visit the Eagle Hunters of Western Mongolia. Lo and behold, I found myself sitting in a chair listening to your recent piece on falconry, having just spent 5 days living with an eagle hunter in the Altai Mountains. Mark's words echoed many of the feelings I had when I held an eagle on my arm for the first time. Your podcasts are inspiring, as always. That's kindly to say, Doug, but your example's pretty inspiring too. Thank
it's
you
quite
very much
humbling.
For that.
We get a lot of them from all over the world saying, you inspired me to come to Scotland, or I listened to you to help improve my English.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was daft, wasn't it? Anyway, earlier we heard Ewan off the coast of Tyree searching for basking sharks. You were out there for quite a wee while with not a lot of success.
Well, none, actually.
Yeah, no.
8 hours we've been out there, and the tradition of this podcast, we've got we saw six here yesterday, and it's all part of a project to establish whether basking sharks come to Scotland to breed, and if they do, then they need special protection. I was out in the boat with Dr. Lucy Hawkes of Exeter University and Dr. Suzanne Henderson from Scottish Natural Heritage. And finally, things were looking up.
We've been at sea for about 6 hours now and no sign of sharks anywhere, but we've had to come inside away from the rough stuff.
Yeah, we're now between Col and Tyree in a place called Gunner Sound. The sea's much flatter here, much calmer. It's better for us because we don't feel seasick anymore, but it's better for the sharks too because it should allow the plankton to kind of like settle on the sea surface, and that's what the basking sharks are going to come and feed on.
But you have seen them here before.
Yeah, we've seen them here loads before. This is a really great place to see basking sharks, so definitely very hopeful that we might yet see one.
One of the reasons you're here is to see if there is a good case for a marine protected area.
Well, the MPA is looking at protecting basking sharks spatially in areas where they aggregate each year, and also areas where we think it's important for their life cycle. So the basking sharks are coming here each year to feed on the plankton-rich waters, but they also display courtship-like behaviour, so nose-to-tail swimming, one in front of the other, and also breaching behaviour, which we all think is linked to courtship. And so it's possible that this area is important for breeding as well.
It comes as a surprise to many people in Scotland that this is a great area for plankton. You know, looking out in this cold sea, you would think this isn't particularly great.
This area is really productive, actually. It's related to the front system around this area, which is basically two water bodies of different depths coming together, mixing nutrients and providing a good environment for plankton. And it's not just basking sharks that feed on that. There's lots of other wildlife here too. We've seen a lot of birds feeding in the area, so the plankton is rich here.
So we have got fish. Just need a big fish.
Yeah, we need the second biggest fish in the world. Doesn't sound like a lot to ask, right?
We've been at sea for about 8 hours now, and folk were getting a bit despondent, but suddenly you've got a smile like a Cheshire cat.
I can't believe that experience. That was just absolutely superb. The basking shark was massive, and it just came alongside very, very slowly and was there for ages. It was just beautiful.
And just that massive mouth. I mean, to put it in some kind of context, as I said, we're seeing nothing. And then suddenly we've got six or seven all around us.
You've just got to have patience, you really do. And yeah, it's been well worth it, hasn't it?
I mean, you saw, looked into the eye, which is quite an unnerving experience, but that wrinkled, mottled, purpley-grey skin is just incredible.
They're all different as well, and that one was just beautiful, and it was just so calm, so close to the boat. It was unbelievable.
It's just like watching a really elegant giant elephant's gliding past you.
It really was, and it's about half the size of the boat, or maybe more than that, actually. It was so calm and majestic.
And what's going on at the moment? The guys are up at the front of the boat. What's going on?
The guys are just resetting the tag. They just need to tie it onto the pole, and we'll be ready to go again.
It's not an easy job, though, is it?
It's not. You've got to have patience. The shark's moving back and forward. We just need to be in the right position.
They don't seem rattled, though.
Not at all. They're intent on feeding. And yeah, that one's so far up on the surface of the water, actually. You can see its nose, tail, everything.
A really distinctive snout, that head in the air and wide open mouth.
And I think this one's a female. We're looking at it with the GoPro on the pole cam. It's just beautiful.
And some of them seem to be single, some seem to be in pairs.
Yeah, that was some of the courtship behaviour as well, nose to tail following two massive sharks just coasting along, feeding at the surface.
And just such a great sight as well. We're just 3 miles off Tyree and the sun's come out. God's in his heaven. It's great.
It's a completely different day from this morning, isn't it? It's just turned flat calm and the sharks are everywhere and the sun's out. It's perfect.
Just need to get the tag on.
Yeah. Just give us a minute. We'll do that now.
I've now come up the front of the boat and you're getting ready to go.
Yeah, pressure's on. It's quite a stressful situation doing this because so many things have to be perfect. The shark has to be tolerant to us approaching it. The shark can choose just to abandon this at any point. It can swim away from us, swim down and get away. And everybody on board's wishing me to get this tag in. The skipper's lining me up, giving me opportunity. Oh, it's a stressful job. It's exciting.
A lot of tension, but a lot of smiles as well.
Yeah, I guess, well, sharks are brilliant, aren't they? I mean, they're massive animals. It's one of the coolest animals you're going to see in the seas in Britain, really.
And you're hanging over the bow and doing the Titanic thing,
yeah,
getting ready to...
I'm kind of stressed right now. I know, yeah, it's very exciting.
The last thing you want is a microphone stuck in your face, so I'll
let
you get
probably.
On with it.
All right, then, thanks. Bye.
There it is.
Oh, there it is. David, on your way. Oh, it has got the tag. Well done, Lucy.
Well done.
You were a bit stressed out 40 seconds ago.
I know, now I'm really happy. Oh my goodness, that went on much easier than I thought. That shark came right up to us. It was amazing. It's always, it's a really special thing when a bit of wildlife comes to you. Like the way that shark has its nose out the water, it's like that bit at the end of Jaws when it's eating the back of the boat. Basking sharks are quite closely related to great white sharks, actually. But yeah, you can see how in a flash of a moment it's all over. Oh.
And you can still see the shark with the tag. It seemed pretty unfazed by it.
I know. And the cool thing is, for 3.5 days, that little camera is going to be filming that shark's every move. Isn't that cool? What we really want now is for that shark to go off and find itself a girlfriend or boyfriend and mate and get it on camera.
You're never
that
happy, are you?
I know. No, I am happy. I'm incredibly happy. I'm just kind of... Oh, I'm quite...
A bit of an adrenaline rush.
I'm very British, so I'm not going to whoop and cheer too much, but, you know...
I heard you from the back of the boat.
I did whoop. I did, actually. Yeah, you're right. I did whoop. Whew, done. Two more to go, though.
Dr. Lucy Hawkes of Exeter University. How many did you see in total?
12 in all. Wow. One lot of six, and then about 2 hours later, another lot of six, and right up beside the boat. And just great to see so many. It was just incredible. As you say, they put the 3-wee cameras on the sharks. They were on for 3 days. I can tell you now they're off now. They're quite a job tracking them down. One decided to take itself off the sky, so they had to get on a ferry and then finally a rib.
Well, they couldn't chase it in their own boat.
Well,
get a ferry.
They were tweeting on social media saying, if anybody sees a wee red camera off the coast of Skye, can we have our cameras
back?
Anyway, they've got them. And we'll bring you some of that footage later in the year with a bit of luck.
Let's go back to the tranquility of Ian Hamilton Finlay's creation, Little Sparta. It's just 5 acres. It's not a big patch at all, but it centres around four main themes, as gardener George Gilliland explained to me.
So there was the Garden of the Sea, the classical garden, and then we start to see references also to the French Revolution. He chose the French Revolution because it happened to tie up with his ideas politically and philosophically, but also in terms of the representations of nature. So they had the Republican calendar, where all the days were renamed after flowers and garden tools and things like that. So that ties in nicely with his worldview. And then we'll start to see things as well to do with the Second World War. So there's an aircraft carrier is just sitting on the edge of the pond.
There are several of those dotted throughout the garden. Yeah. And the idea of having, which he did have, a fascination with the aesthetics of the Second World War. I mean, that's a really unusual idea.
I guess it is. But, I mean, to him, for instance, the outline of a battleship was as beautiful as a Corinthian capital on top of a column. I mean, and he knows that these things contain within them a certain controversy, but he's asking us to look at things in a different way. He's demilitarising them, but looking at them for their aesthetic values as well. And often you will get a visual jolt where he uses motifs or things that you just really don't expect in the context of garden, like hand grenades, for instance, or things like that.
How well is this garden known to the wider public? I mean, do people come up this track?
Oh, very, very much so. But it's only open during the summertime, and that's intentional. That's where he wanted it to be seen. Look at its best, and all of the effects with the tree canopy and full leaf would work. It is probably better known internationally, I would say, rather than even locally. I mean, I live in the town down the road, and I will often mention to people that I work here, and they will say, oh, I didn't realise that was there, or I've always meant to visit. And it's just one of those things, but it should be better known and recognised for what it is. It's a unique artwork in a unique setting.
You are living and working in a finite artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, this garden will, you know, I mean, the trees will grow, they will, to the point where they will die. Mm-hmm. It might not be in your lifetime, mm-hmm. but even the concept of introducing new plants, do you do that?
Oh, yes. So we do try to keep it looking as it should be. So you do have to gauge where trees can be taken out or replaced. Even within the wild garden, there are very formal spaces. So those need to be kept. The garden will change as time goes on. It's inevitable, even through the seasons. I mean, like working here in the winter, it is a very different feeling to how it is presented in the summertime to the public. So I see it in all weathers, on a day like today with a nice soft rain. It looks and feels differently to how it will in dappled sun and shade and things like that. And different sounds, different sensory experiences, they're all contained within this all the time. So it's alive as an artwork. It's not just something which will pass. Because it's now kept by the trust, it would be kept in perpetuity and go on. So it should continue to exist.
Just as we were talking there, San Martins just flew past within feet of us. That you're looking down on this loch of water, which is dark, but reflected in the loch, you've got the yellow of the flag irises. There are these pokers of foxgloves standing up, trees behind that, lots of willow, sycamore, that kind of thing. But we are surrounded by heather, ling, blaberry. It's just, classic moorland plants and things. You would never get to the stage of thinking, I know this.
No, it's a continual process of discovery and coming across things which make you see and understand it differently. So even within the landscape that you've described, the intervention of an artwork in the middle of a wild place, you have a formal grove of trees or a big intervention in terms of stones and a carving set in front of you. And I think that that's what this garden does. It's asking you questions all the time about the purpose of a garden or the purpose of your intervention in the landscape. So it's asking you bigger ideas about what that could possibly mean. And it very much sets you within the broader landscape that you've described with the water and the trees and the hills beyond. You're part of something bigger, but very much you're set in this place.
This is interesting.
Well, and then in front of us we find what was the final artwork which was realised in the garden. It was a collapsed barn or outbuilding, and it was deliberately rebuilt as a ruin to contain within it a formal garden. So the idea of a hortus conclusus, a medieval garden, is almost appropriate as a finishing point for the garden. In the final room, there's a little circular pool with the names of the clouds inscribed around it in Latin. So it's pulling down a little bit of the sky to earth. So a visual full stop.
Uh-huh.
Very appropriate in a day like today.
Yeah. Listen to the rain. Just the wind blowing the drops off the trees. Stratocumulus. And ivy growing up this pink sandstone. You say this isn't found art. I mean, this entire garden is a work of art. You could spend days here.
The constantly surprising little Sparta. And if you'd like to visit the garden for yourself, it's in the Pentland Hills and it's open Thursday to Sunday until September.
We've been doing this programme for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just so incredible. Every week you come up with another part of Scotland that folk can come and see.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should be getting sponsored by the tourist board here.
We're missing a trick somewhere, that's for
sure.
You
stand at the airport, here's your podcast.
Yes. Just crack on you go. Now, we heard you and earlier on the hunt for basking sharks, and basking sharks are big. They're massive creatures. Live, possibly, breed in Scottish waters off the west coast. But you've also been on the trail of something else.
Yeah, there's a strange tale and strange sightings that were real in Orkney. Scotland is no stranger to tales of sea monsters. Ever since man took to the sea in boats, mariners have returned with wondrous stories of serpents that inhabit the tidal races like the Corryvreckan, the Pentland Firth, and the Sound of Jura. Monsters that would emerge from the deep and drag a passing boat to the bottom of the whirlpools and the waters which boil with the power of the tide. But some monsters have been seen and well documented, like the animal that came to be called the Stronsay Beast. It was real. It existed. It defied experts, and parts of this odd creature exist to this day. On the 25th of October, 1808, a local fisherman, John Peace, was fishing off Rothesum Head at the southwest of Stronsay when he spotted seagulls flocking over what he thought looked like a carcass on the rocks. He rowed his boat closer to get a good look. On the land, another man, one George Shearer, also from Stronsay, watched as John rowed to the land. John Peace was shocked at what he found. The thing was decomposing but still intact, and what he saw he described as a serpent. A massive serpent, a long, thin neck. Stiff hairs ran down its back, and on the trunk, three pairs of what looked like limbs. The body was lying at the foot of the inaccessible cliffs, of Rothesum Head. So we had to leave the beast where it was, and it was carried off on the tide. But 10 days later, after a massive storm, the creature was washed up once again, discovered by George Shearer, just below the tide line. Three others joined the scene and began taking notes. Part of the tail was missing, but in total the monster, and it was indeed a monster, was measured at 55 feet. The neck alone was over 10 feet. It had a head like a sheep, eyes bigger than a seal's, and covered with grey, rough skin. Six limbs and rough bristles that glowed in the dark when wet. This was indeed a scary discovery. But a discovery that would be hard to prove. The men were taken to Kirkwall, where they gave evidence before a magistrate to ensure that the details of the Stronsay beast were preserved. The Orcadian newspaper at the time ran this account. Its flesh was coarse, like ill-coloured beef, entirely covered in fat and tallow, and without the least resemblance or affinity to fish. In November 1808, the Natural History Society of Edinburgh examined the reports and failed to identify which species it was. And eventually, the Scottish anatomist John Barclay declared it a new species. And so Halcidrus pontopedani was born. Pontopedan's sea snake. It was the Danish historian Pontopedan who was the first to describe the infamous Scandinavian monster, the Kraken, in 1755. Sir Alexander Gibson made a sketch of the Stronsay beast in 1808, and it does indeed look strange. If the Loch Ness monster had a saltwater cousin, then this was it. Or was it? The evidence was again checked by naturalist Sir Everard Home, and he came to a very different conclusion. He checked the vertebrae against that of another massive sea creature and found them to be identical. He concluded it was nothing more than a really big basking shark. But how could the fishermen and experts of Edinburgh get it so wrong? Well, the answer may lie in the way a basking shark decomposes after death. First to go are the massive jaws. They're only held with a small piece of cartilage, which quickly rots, and then the jaws fall off, leaving what looks like a long neck and a small head. Next is the lower half of the tail fin, which leaves a long tail, the tail of a serpent. And as the upper part finally disintegrates, the upper section of the spine emerges through the skin to give a bristle-like effect. The limbs, possibly the remains of fins. There was an attempt to analyse small fragments of the monster in the 80s for DNA, but it would appear that never happened. But there is still one big mystery. The largest basking shark ever found was in 1851, and it came in at 40 feet. The Orkney shark, if indeed that's what it was, measured at 55 feet plus the missing bit of the tail. Was it a basking shark, or was it really a beast from the deep? Perhaps we'll never know.
You can't help yourself, can you?
What?
I mean, you come up with a mystery, you solve the mystery, and then you say, ah, yes, but was it?
Because there's more mystery.
There's always more mystery.
The one off Nova Scotia was 40 feet long. That's the biggest one that's ever been recorded. Mm-hmm. This one's 55 feet.
With a bit missing.
With a bit missing off the tail, so it could be 20 feet longer than the one's the biggest one ever found. That's a bit of a mystery.
Might just be a coincidence.
You're swimming off the coast of Orkney.
Swim fast.
Take care.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for on this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. We will be back next week from the BBC Aberdeen car park with yet another edition, and possibly one midweek if I can scram something in. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.